will be a little short today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. If you don't have time to read War and Peace, we have some shorter works for your consideration on Scribble. And short works they are. You've been a great fan of short stories for a long time.
Oh, I grew up on short stories. I grew up, I suppose, in what you would call the heyday of short stories.
Well, now, you're presuming that you've actually grown up.
Well.
I mean, you've definitely gotten older.
Well, short stories got me through the 50s and the 60s. You know, I suppose from the 1930s to about 1960, 65, those were the heyday of short stories. Every magazine, Saturday Evening Post, the Colliers, had short stories in them. Good Housekeeping had short stories in it. There was a huge market. Every genre, you know, Astounding Science Fiction and about four other science fiction monthlies came out with short stories. Mystery had short stories. Romances had short stories. The short stories were everywhere.
Well, there used to be, Ellery Queen magazine consisted of short stories.
We still have some of those, in fact.
And there were all these Westerns my grandfather used to read.
Oh, the Westerns were probably more popular than any of the ones I've already mentioned. And
In terms of that magazines, though, Colliers and the rest of those have kind of gone away.
Well, and so has the popular market for short stories.
Yeah.
You know, It's rare that you find a source unless you subscribe to one of the little literary journals or one of the hundreds of online journals now that don't even publish, but publish. It turns out that short stories are alive and well. It's just that most of your typical readers have no access to them. Alive and well, every summer, the Chicago Tribune has a Nelson Algren short story contest. And this year, I think, and last year, too, they got in the neighborhood of 3,000 entries.
Wow.
And
a lot of short story
they published the top entries, and this year's was really fantastic. It was in a neighborhood in Chicago, I believe it was, a survivor of the Nazi death camps and a Nazi guard at one of those death camps develop a strange relationship with each other.
Yeah.
So really good stories are being written today.
Yeah.
But very few of them are being read.
You know, the most famous short story of all, I think, is The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. That caused a sensation when it was first published, and boy, people wrote about that for and against for a long time.
It's on my list. It was unfortunate for Shirley Jackson because she is indeed a very good writer, but she wrote one book that was good.
That's true.
That nothing else. It's like, Steinbeck and Grapes of Wrath. You know, he did himself a disservice to write that because every review after that, and that was midway in his career, said, well, it's not Grapes of Wrath.
But I actually did not encounter The Lottery right away. I read The Haunting of Hill House, and then We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which were great, great stories. Boy, I mean, Haunting of Hill House just makes your flesh creep as you read it. And the surprising thing about We Have Always Lived in the Castle, it has an eerie feeling to it, but it's essentially a love story. It's just one of the most amazing novels I've ever read. And I love Shirley Jackson, but The Lottery is a very cruel and vivid short story.
I've spent a career trying to get my grandchildren to read it, and I think so far one has, actually. And her response was creepy.
I should mention, we're going to talk not only about short stories, but about columnists as well, because that is an essay form. But before we do that, I want to mention that WVIK is in a fund drive. Now, these are complicated things to do in the middle of a pandemic. If you come to the station, you have to wear a mask, you have to be admitted, you have to be socially distanced and so on. And the idea of having a battery of people answering telephones is simply out of the question. So we cannot ask you to call the telephone number to make your pledge today, which is the quick and convenient way to do it. But you can certainly contact us on your computer at wvik.org. It's a very simple process. You'll see immediately, I think it says pledge here, and we would solicit your contributions. During these times, so many social services desperately need your help, and we encourage you to give as generously as you can. But we believe that WVIK also serves the heart and the mind, if not the body. And we hope that you will make a contribution to keep this service alive and strong. You're a great source for news, local and international, and also the great consolation of classical music through the week, and a hodgepodge of things here on Saturday, all of them with their own particular audience. And the thing that keeps it going is your contribution. So think about that, and remember, it's simple, wvik.org.
And you'll also discover, if you listen to the news, that there's more going on than the pandemic and the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem with the national news programs now have, you know, they just can't stay away from two or three major things. There are other interesting things going on in the world and important things.
That's always been the case. The news can always chases one thing. But one newspaper article I discovered in the New York Times was interesting. It's by David Quammen, Quammen. He wrote Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. So he was out ahead of this. But he's written a page-long article called Consider the Virus's Point of View. And it really is a wonderful explanation of just how the virus works. There is no ethical component in its actions. It simply does what nature impels it to do. And as long as we continue to intrude into nature, the viruses which live comfortably in animals, when they escape to humans, suddenly find a whole new vista. It's like colonists discovering America and the broad plains and all the opportunities there. That's what it looks like to the coronavirus when it enters the human body. And says you can't blame it for doing that, but you just have to find a way to cope with it. And we seem to be spectacularly unsuccessful in coping right now.
Well, even compared to other, our per capita rate of infections and death is way up among the highest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's really, it's terrible. It truly is. But if you can get hold of that from Sunday, September 20th, Consider the Virus's Point of View by David Quammen. I won't even try to pronounce that. So that's my bit on columns. Speaking of the New York Times, too, way back in September 13th, in their Sunday edition, I only get the Sunday edition, they have a full section called Greed is Good Except When It's Bad. And they talk about in 1970, they published The Social Responsibility of Business is to Increase Its Profits by Milton Friedman. A concept that really screwed up corporate America in terms of how it affects us for all time. And what they do in this is reprint that essay, which is very logical and straightforward, but they also put in comments from other people as to how this has turned out to be a disaster. So that's way back in September 13th. I don't know what the process is, but I would go on to the internet at newyorktimes.com and see what luck you have. But greed is good except when it's bad. This is from the September 13th edition. And consider the virus's point of view is from September 20th. That's my opening shot for newspaper columnists. Your turn.
Well, this started out, you know, after we had that session or two on huge books, books that comprehend everything, right? And from the beginning of time to the end of time and so forth and so on. And then I realized we haven't really done a lot in this program, even though we're in just starting our seventh year, with short stories.
Uh-huh.
And short stories are our most recent literary form. I mean, the poem, the play, the novel, the saga, the epic, the fable, and so forth, those are much older. But the short story is really only about 150 years old as a short story. When we say short story, I guess what I'm thinking, because I grew up with that, my teachers all told me, that what makes a short story is not only its length, but the fact that it has a plot, and then at the end there's a surprise ending, ideally. Right?
Oh, Henry,
and,
yeah.
Oh, Henry, of course. Oh, Henry is the constant example, and the example that almost everybody, I'm assuming, that's been through the school system has read, is the one about the young couple that the gift of the Magi.
Yeah, everybody's read that, I think.
Yeah, and but it turns out that, you know, what's happened to the short story since about the short story went through a period in the 60s and 70s of wild experimentation. Donald Bartlemy and a group of others took the old idea of the surprise ending and the nice plot. You know, plot disappeared from the world, and it's disappearing from fiction too. But they did all kinds of experiments, including who could write the shortest short story, right? How short could a short story be? And I think it's Donald Bartlemy that wrote this one, and I know it by heart because it isn't easy to, I mean, it isn't hard to memorize. Be careful, Frank, said the angel. If you say the word doyen, you will die. Doyen, said Frank, and he died. End of the story. And so fiction just got totally freaky for a long, long time. And a little bit of that is still alive today. We've interviewed, in fact, a couple of people on Scribble who write what today is called flash fiction.
Oh,
fiction,
yeah.
That's complete, mm-hmm. on a page or two. But the old-fashioned short story, you know, I think back on some of the great short stories I've read, they all fit the old mold of somewhat of a plot and then a kind of twist at the end. What can a short story do that a novel can't do better? A novel, I guess you would say, is a painting of a landscape, the whole Teton mountain range, whereas a short story is a close-up picture of a glacier lily in spring on one of the Teton mountains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, I think of The New Yorker. The New Yorker had a new standard of short story.
Right.
And it was different from everything else. So the models have come and gone. Do you have a list of your favorite short stories? You mentioned one earlier.
Yeah, this got started when I was talking to one of the readers for The Blind that I haven't seen now for 5 months because we're not in operation. About a story that I'm desperate to get him to read because I want his impressions of it. It's E.M. Forster's The Celestial Omnibus.
The Celestial Omnibus.
That is a beautiful story. And having mentioned that he ought to read it, I think everybody ought to read it. You can get a hold of it on Google. You don't even have to buy a copy, I think. I think it's out of copyright. It's about a young boy who grows up in a rather stuffy family with pretenses to literary greatness, who comes home one day and said, you know, in the alley he found a bus that said to heaven. This is Shelley. Shelley got kicked out of school for writing at the end of an alley an arrow pointing upwards and the words to heaven. And this boy said, no, I really did ride the omnibus to heaven. And come on now. And that sounds like Shelley. And they have five Shelleys in their home. They haven't read any of them, but they've got them, right, bound in beautiful editions. And the poor boy is forced to memorize poetry because he's been bad and lying about going to heaven. Well, it turns out there really is a celestial omnibus. It is a beautiful story. It is a beautiful story. So if you can get a hold of it and if you've got a little time to read and then the rest of the day to reflect, read E.M. Forster's The Celestial Omnibus.
Okay. Before you go to another one, I want to mention again, we have about 10 minutes left here. This is a fun drive period for WVIK. If you have the inclination and the will, we would give you the opportunity, but unfortunately we cannot ask you to phone because it is impossible in these pandemic conditions, and we do take them seriously, to have a bank of people answering the phone over in the break room. So we ask you to use the computer, wvik.org. Be as generous as you can. There are some people who pledge $10 a month via their credit card. That's wonderful, but it doesn't have to be that. It can be whatever amount you judge you can easily handle. You might even want to make a very slight sacrifice because WVIK is dependent on our listeners. The funding at the national level continues to drift down, and as they cut taxes for the wealthy, they cut services for everybody else. So it becomes more and more incumbent on us to remind our listeners that this service really depends on you. The bulk of what we have to operate with comes from our listeners. And so if you are among them, we hope you will look at WVIK.org and make a pledge. I want to go to the writings of Gary Wills. Gary Wills, I will read anything he writes. What caught my attention is a collection of columns called Lead Time that was published back in the 80s. And I just finished reading an exhaustive biography of Dorothy Day. And I looked in this book and on, two, three pages, he has enough on Dorothy Day to satisfy everyone. One of the things he says here, if I may read, in many days, Dorothy was not saintly. She could hold a grudge, explode with anger, resent others' curiosity about her, alternately smother and strand her daughter. Dorothy Day was not a saint because she was good, but because she got dragooned into a job. What is a saint's job? To be in all circumstances so focused on the divine presence that the world gets lit through from the other side by the intensity of one's gaze at and beyond immediate surroundings. It is a thankless job, since real saints scare people who try to tame them by reducing them to saintliness. Saintliness is, in that sense, private and irrelevant. Being a saint is the ultimate challenge to others. He goes on to talk about she could struggle, keep loving the poor, but she also kept hating the lice they brought. St. Francis was, no doubt, much more hospitable to Brother Flea. Dorothy died with her allies and followers at an acute stage of their perpetual inner squabblings, a fate that she shared with Francis. What, then, did she accomplish? Nothing but what a saint always does and must. She bore witness. She brought the message. She came from God. Beautiful writing. Gary Wills is one of my icons.
I have a strange relationship with Gary Wills. For some reason, I've never really liked him very well until I pick up one of his books and start reading it. And then I say, "Tweet, where have you been?" You know, I mean,
the thing that kills me about this, and the thing that inhibits me, is I read stuff by Gary Wills and others, and I think, why can't I write that like that? What's wrong with me? Why can't I do that?
Well, you need a pencil and a paper, or you need a typewriter, and you need to start doing it, Don.
I know.
And if you did start doing it,
it's the discipline.
It.
It's the discipline
it
that
is.
Stops me, yeah.
Oh.
Because I am not a disciplined person.
Yeah, I mean, the writers, my mantra as a writer is, well, it's already Thursday. I guess I'll start on Monday.
I'm right in line with that.
Oh.
I hate it. But anyway, so back to your, before we run completely out of time, give us a list of short stories we should read besides the Celestial Omnibus and the Lottery.
I need to talk a little bit about them too, so we'll have to maybe have another session on this. My ideal short story, particularly for teaching the short story, because everything, the setting, the style, the point of view, all fit together, is a little simple story by Catherine Mansfield called Miss Brill. Miss Brill, about an elderly lady who goes in London, who every Sunday afternoon goes to a park and sits on a bench and to watch the listen to the band and watch the people go by. Some people she loves, little young couples who are in love, sailors and their girlfriends, and then people she just can't stand are old people who never say anything and sit by themselves, which of course is Miss Brill.
How do you spell her last name?
B-R-I-L-L.
Okay, Brill.
Starting with the name, Brill is both brilliant and chill, and it's incomplete. I mean, everything about this story, this to me is the perfect short story, particularly if you want to know what a short story is.
By Catherine Mansfield.
Mansfield. She's a great short story writer. For me, the best short story, you know, if I had to give one short story out for people to read, it would be Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener.
Oh, yeah.
In which an elderly gentleman who owns a writing business, before Xerox, you had to hire clerks to make copies of legal wills and stuff, copy after copy, so that literally there were people who spent their lives writing, but they were writing other people's words. I mean, can you think of a worse hell? And into this is hired somebody named Bartleby. And things go from bad to worse. And the owner of the business who hired Bartleby at the end has to decide whether to be a good Christian or to be a good businessman. And there is no way he can be both.
That is...
And it is an incredible story to think about and discuss about. And the character is so well drawn. A lighter guy who has completely fallen off the map is Ring Lardner.
Who's that?
Ring Lardner, the Chicago writer, who wrote Haircut.
Oh, Ring Lardner.
Haircut, almost everybody wrote. And I put Ring Lardner in here. Almost all of his stuff is incredibly funny. And biting and witty and sarcastic. But he's got the great all-time line that I've used on several women that I know. And here's the line. "Shut up," she explained.
Yeah, that is. famous line. I want to get a word in for another book that I mentioned in passing. Arguing with Zombies by Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman is an improbable winner of the Nobel Memorial Prize. Improbable because they always go to guys who write in favor of banks. But he writes very objectively. And one of his favorite phrases is the zombie syndrome. said Ronald Reagan passed a big tax cut in August 81. As it happens, the U.S. economy was just entering a recession. By late 1982, the economy began to recover, experiencing 2 years of very rapid growth. 1981 is the year in which they passed a tax cut. It was supposed to solve everything, but it didn't. And he says that zombie notion that tax cuts for the wealthy will increase life, the possibilities of life and business for everyone, did not work then, and it has never worked since. And yet they keep doing it. Says it's a zombie idea that keeps moving along, eating legislators' brains. Arguing with Zombies is a huge collection of Paul Krugman's essays, or columns, I should say, and it's well worth your time. Okay, Roel, I give you a couple minutes to give us another short story.
Well, if you want to go off the deep end and love experimental, strange, weird fiction, the most important writer, I think, to never have won the Nobel Prize is Jorge Borges, the Argentinian writer. He didn't call his work short stories. He called them ficciones. But almost anything you pick up by him will just take you into a whole different world. I would suggest particularly The Library of Babel, which is a library of octagonal rooms, endless rooms, in which everything that can ever be written is written. And you will find them on the shelves. Most of it, of course, makes nonsense because, you know, if you got monkeys down typewriter to typewriter, they might type out the first line of "How do I love thee?" But then they would be gibberish. But eventually, if monkeys typed enough, they would type out "How do I love thee? Let me count thy ways." And so, right, and this is a Borges is just phenomenal.
Spell his name.
B O R G H E S.
Okay, B O R. Okay, gotcha. And that'll about do it. Before we go, though, I want to remind you once again that this is Fun Drive time. And we are hoping that you will take the time to make us not a phone call because we can't have a battery of answers here in pandemic times. But the computer is our lifeline. If you would like to make a contribution, we ask that you go to wvik.org. There you will find all the instructions you need for making a contribution. We ask that you be as generous as you can because WVIK depends on the support of its listeners. It's a two-way street. You send us money, we send you programming, and we offer you the best combination of news you're going to find on radio in this market, indeed in many markets. We're very proud of the work that NPR does. We're also quite proud of our own local news staff. They work very hard to keep you up to date with what's happening here and around the world. And, of course, the consolation of great music is something all of us really need in these troubled times. So it's WVIK.org. I'm Don Woot with Roel Tweet. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week to talk about books. We hope you'll join us for the next edition of Scribble.